Way back when I was thinking about starting a high-ticket dropshipping business, the one thing I was looking for was someone to show me what one of these sites looks like. So John and I have done that for you at dropshipbreakthrough.com/go. So head to dropshipbreakthrough.com/go and watch the free training.
Welcome to the Dropship Podcast, where you'll learn how to build and grow a high-ticket dropshipping business and hear stories from successful e-commerce entrepreneurs. Let's kick this thing off.
Hey, welcome to the Dropship Podcast. John here today for a solo episode. In this episode, I'm going to be chatting through a whole bunch of high-ticket dropshipping and business-related questions. So it's an Ask Me, Dropshipping Ask Me Anything session that was originally happened in our Facebook group. And there were so many good questions in here that I just thought we needed to chuck this out on our podcast so that more people who are interested in high-ticket dropshipping and starting their own business can listen in. So in this episode, I'm answering questions about Google Ads, about niche selection, about dealing with suppliers, about when to know if a niche isn't working out for you and you should move on, you should change approach, about should you be selling products that you're passionate in or not. There's a whole bunch of cool questions, many more, and we have a good chat about all of those things. So tune in. This is a longer form episode, but there's a ton of high-ticket dropshipping gold in here. So without further ado, let's dive in right now to the first question. And Joey's question is, how do you prioritize tasks in the early days of a new store? And then as a sub comment, he put between focusing on adding new products, getting new suppliers, marketing, etc. Good question, Joey, and thank you for that. It's a question we get a lot, I think. And I think I've kind of dived into this. I actually dived into this a little bit on the last live I did in this group, which I think was back in late February, maybe. And that's also been on our podcast as well, which was an episode there where I talked about, you know, what do you need to do? What should you focus on? What should you prioritize to hit your first 6,000 in profit? So this is a similar question, I guess. And once you get into launching your business, you know, it's kind of like the world becomes your oyster in terms of there's so many things that you could do. There's so many directions that you could go in. There's a lot of different marketing strategies and tactics that will start to take up your attention. You know, you could get more suppliers. You could get more products. Ideally, you know, you've got ads to manage now. You're probably getting some customer inquiries, hopefully, you know, maybe starting to make some sales. So you've got some customer service there. So there can be, feel like there's a lot to do and there's a lot that you could do in those early days of launching your business. And it does take a little while, I think, to sort of work out where your priorities should lie and just to kind of get into the swing of actually running a business. But to Joey's question, I think there's really, like in the early days of a new store, there's really three things. And Joey lists them, like new products, getting new suppliers. So when you launch your new store, you know, before you launch, you're going to talk to some suppliers, you're going to get their products on your store. There's still going to be a whole bunch of other suppliers that you could go out and get in most cases. And you should continue to contact them and seek approval from suppliers, including the ones who said no or you didn't get an answer to in your first round of calls after you launch. In fact, you should keep doing that for your first 12 months consistently, to be honest, because one of the big differences for a high-ticket dropshipping business in terms of how many sales you're going to make and how much progress you're going to make often comes down to which brands do you have on your site within your market. Some brands, some suppliers work better than others. Some products sell better than others. And so if you've got as much product as you can, as great a representation of your niche on your site as you can, your chances of making sales are dramatically increased. And it's kind of one of the superpowers of being a high ticket dropshipper or a dropshipper is that you have no real overheads in terms of selling products, in terms of having the products there. You don't have a warehouse. You don't have to physically have the products before you can sell them. And so that's an advantage that you have as a dropshipper. Conversely, there are some disadvantages as a dropshipper, i.e. you don't get tend to get the same profit margins as somebody who does hold large quantities of stock. So you have to take advantage of your superpowers to
And that kind of balances out the negative aspects of dropshipping, which, you know, we're always quite clear that there are some, right? So I would certainly be prioritizing getting more suppliers. Now, that's not going to take up all your time, right? Gradually, you're going to get more suppliers after you launch. And so you're still going to have a stream of new products to add. So once again, getting those products on your site as quickly as you can is a priority, because once they're on your site, then you can put them in your ads, then you can start testing them, you can start selling them, or you can at least determine what products are likely to get customers' interest and what aren't based on the traffic that they generate, right? So you want to get to that as quickly as possible. Now, if you've got the funds to do so, I would highly recommend outsourcing uploading products to your site. So if you can do it, that is something you should do as soon as possible. It's a time-consuming task. It's repetitive. It's manual. That is the perfect task to outsource. So once again, if you don't have the funds because you're a bit tight on cash when you first get started, that's cool. Do it yourself. But if you can take that off your plate, take it off your plate. Manage somebody who does that. And it's a task that you can get done by somebody else at a very low price. You know, and it's a very process-driven task. So it's not hard to train somebody to do that. It's probably one of the best, it's the best way you can get dip your toe into building a team. Getting somebody else to work alongside you is with uploading products. So I would say definitely do that if you can. Now, when it comes, so you're getting new suppliers, uploading products, you're going to be running ads once you've launched. So you need to get good at running ads, managing your Google shopping. Make sure you've got that nailed in. Make sure you understand exactly what you're doing there. And if you're not sure, reach out to somebody and get help. Somebody who actually understands what you're doing there. And I would say a lot of people launch their business and, you know, themselves using content that they found online, listening to our podcast, the Dropship Podcast, which is fantastic that people launch their business just from listening to our show. But this is where I start to see people fall down going that approach, is that when you get to marketing and running ads, and there's so many little bits and pieces that have to come together to that, you're just not going to pick it all up based off free content. So you have to have, I think, somebody or a group or peers or something that you can lean on, or a course or something to actually show you the nuance of marketing, because it's a little bit different in every market. And I commonly see people who think they're getting the Google ads right who really aren't. And it's usually because they're just kind of making it up as they go. So however you work it out, you've got to learn how to do that properly, and then you've got to do it properly and consistently properly. So products, suppliers, ads, Google Shopping, Bing Shopping, you know, maybe a few other ads, and then conversion rate optimization. That's the next priority. So once you start getting traffic to your site, you want to make sure that your site has your offer built into it, your product pages. You want to work out an offer that sits well within your market and all of that sort of thing. And you want to make sure that that's communicated to people on your product pages. When somebody comes to your site, you know, in the early days, most people are going to land on your product pages. Nobody's landing on collection pages or your homepage, right? The first impression is made on your product pages here. And so that's where you've got to present the marketing case for why, the persuasion argument for why somebody should buy from you and not somebody else. When you're high ticket dropshipping, you're usually a reseller. So you're selling a product that other people are also selling. Most customers are going to be aware of that. And so it's not just about your product page persuading them that the product is the right product for them to buy. It's also about your website persuading them that once that question is satisfied, their next question in the customer's mind is, where am I going to buy this thing from, right? And so you need to start working on that. And I would say a little tip as well here is work out a way that you can encourage people to call your business, right? The more people you talk to when you sell high-ticket dropshipping products, the more sales you're going to make. There's no arguments about that. I know some people get into this, and this is not pointing this one at you, Joe. Some people get into high-ticket dropshipping, and they're like, oh, I just want to, you know, be completely hands-off, and I run an e-commerce business where I make lots of sales and I don't really deal much with customers and blah, blah, blah. That's just a bullshit lie. That doesn't happen, right? It's not going to happen. You got to talk to people. And so find a way on your product pages to encourage people to call your business. That's just a little tip. You'll make more sales that way. Outside of those things that I've just said, I wouldn't focus on anything else. You know, I mean, if you're getting past those things, what's the next thing? It's SEO, right? But email marketing, retargeting, I'm not worrying about those things in the beginning. You can get to 100,000 in sales a month just doing the things that I just said. Nothing, and nothing else. Like literally nothing else. Wouldn't worry about anything else. Don't sit there thinking about all social media, this, blah, 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 that. Like, nah, just those things. Don't write blogs. Don't post content. Don't do any of that stuff. You don't need to do that stuff, right? If you focus on those four things I said, that's enough to get you to a point where you know, where you've got profit coming in, et cetera, et cetera. If you can't get to a point where you've got profit coming in, then you haven't got those things right. Or you're in a niche that's not going to work out for some reason, right? Now, if you followed the right process to identify your niche, that's unlikely to happen. It does happen from time to time. And once again, find somebody who can give you advice on that and get advice from them as to whether or not you're in a niche that's no good. So thanks for your question, Joey. Right, now I'm going to flip over to a live question. I'll kind of alternate between the two. Matt, thank you for your question. You like my haircut? I like my haircut too. Thank you. Quick question regarding updating Australian business number. We have moved from sole trader to a company structure. What is the best way to update Shopify, Google Ads, Merchant Center, etc.? Easy question. Just go and do it. there's no trick to it. Just go in and update stuff. Like, you know, if there's anywhere you need to put, you know, you'll have a new company name. Like, to be honest, I don't think you really need to worry about that too much. Like, you might update the billing section of your Shopify account. You've probably got an Australian company number now. You might want to put the name of your company in there for billing purposes. But like Google Ads, Merchant Center, etc., you know, if it's up and running and it's working, your website name hasn't changed when you change company structure. I would leave everything as your website name if possible. The less you muck around with like billing in Google Ads, honestly, these days, the better. So customers don't need to know that stuff, right? I wouldn't overthink it. I mean, in areas you need to do it and just do it. But if you don't need to do it, then don't do it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just struggling to think of all the places that you need to do it, honestly, because really, you should be using your website name really as your business name as much as possible, because your company is going to be, whatever your company name is, trading as your website name. So customers are going to know your business by your website name, not your company name. Now, sometimes they might be the same thing, but other times they might be different. So look, I really don't overthink that. But if possible, don't touch the billing settings of your Google Ads account. Unless you really need to. That's my advice, because they get a bit funny about that sort of stuff sometimes. Thanks, Matt, for the question. All right, flipping over to pre-submitted questions. Again, John asked the question, margins seem to be quite an issue with suppliers in his niche, even after gaining some sales for them. What's the best way to approach this? And also, so second part's the question, how can we get potential customers to purchase from us instead of the supplier or the ghastly Amazon, particularly with pricing being so tight? Well, like I say, multi-part question there for John. So I'll try bits of that. Look, I mean, margins with suppliers, if they're tight and you've made some sales, which it sounds like is the case, that's fantastic. Look, I mean, it's a pretty simple conversation, and they're either going to help you or they're not, right? I mean, I'm not going to pretend there's any magic trick to this, but I would be, you know, having a chat with them, and I would be making sure that when I have a chat with them about margins, that I'm not just going in and asking them for a better margin, but I've got some numbers. So I'm going to go into them and I'm going to say, look, you know, we've been making some sales for you. That's great. That's fantastic. You know, we're enjoying our relationship, this relationship and working together. Small problem we have is that there's the economics aren't quite working out for us, right? And this is what it looks like. And then I would actually step them through real numbers around selling their products. So we're buying it from you for this. The retail price is here. This is our cost of marketing. This is the cost of shipping. What are your overheads? Blah, blah, blah. And we're left with this at the end of selling one of your products. So I would actually step it out with real numbers. I wouldn't just make it all airy-fairy and theoretical and whatnot in the air. Like, give it actual numbers, because your next thing is, like, we're running a business here. The point of a business is to produce profit. You get this, right? Because you're running a business. Like, do you think this works out? Like, just put it on them. Just say, look, this, like, obviously respectfully, but, like, put it on them and say, how does that look to you? Are we able to do something here with margins to, you know, make this a bit more of a win-win situation, right? Like, I mean, that's the reality is, and you're catching that in so that we can go and sell more of your products, because at the moment, this doesn't work out for us. There is no incentive for us to increase our efforts to sell your products, because increasing our efforts to sell your products is probably going to cost us a bit more. And it's going to squeeze those margins even more. So the choice we have is to sell more of your products or to go and sell more of somebody else's products. You know, somebody else is going to offer us a better deal and increase their market share of the market. Like, that's just the reality. It's business. This is not personal. It's just business. Numbers don't lie, right? That's what you've got to put to them. Now, if you have that conversation and they don't want to budge on it, then there's not much you're going to do past that. Your choice is exactly the choice that I just said. Don't prioritize them, sell them less, whatnot. I mean, if it's that way across a whole, your whole niche, and you've exhausted the supplies that you could get in that niche, then maybe that's a niche problem, right? Now, the second part of that question was, how can we get potential clients to purchase from us instead of the supplier or the ghastly Amazon? Look, I'm going to be honest. In my experience, I have rarely ever sold high ticket products that are also sold on Amazon, like very rarely. In my experience, that's not usually the case. So I don't think Amazon is a massive problem. Once again, I mean, there may be a niche specific thing, but like, I've been across hundreds of niches and I've never seen that as a significant issue. The supplier bit is a little bit more common. So some suppliers do sell direct to customer, of course, but there's some nuance here. Some do it actively and some don't actually really do it, i.e. they may have the ability to for the customer to buy on their website, but they're not actually marketing their website. Now, that's not a problem. Most customers will not be buying for them. But the problem is more where you see suppliers who are actively advertising their products in the same spaces that you are going to be advertising your product. So in Google shopping ads, et cetera, et cetera. In that scenario, you know, you have to think about it a little more. And you may choose not to compete in that space, or you may choose to. I mean, there's different ways. There's actually quite a few different ways of coming at this. Once again, you may choose not, like, personally, and even between me and Ben, there's some differences here. Right? Like, he's not so worried by it. Personally, I will not advertise against brands in Google Shopping. So, like, if they're going direct to customer, I won't advertise there, because in my experience, and I've actually done this, so I have solid experience in this, you don't win in that scenario, right? Your ads still get clicked on. Assuming all other things are equal, most of the customers end up buying with the supplier, right? So I just tend to avoid those suppliers. And once again, if I was doing my niche research and I saw that was the case at my niche research, that most of the suppliers were doing that, I wouldn't go into that niche. But what you may find in that scenario is you can still sell those products organically, right? Through SEO and those sort of practices, because the funnel is very different. You're getting customers at a different stage of their customer journey when you're generating organic traffic. And so I find sometimes that those type of products sell better that way. And so I might not advertise them, but I may try and promote them through an organic traffic funnel, which over time for a high ticket dropshipping business should become your biggest traffic source anyway. The other way you can come at it sometimes as well is going back to my answer to a previous question around, as a high ticket dropshipper, you have superpowers, right, that other retailers don't have. So one of your superpowers, as well as being able to carry as many products as you want within your niche, is that you sell as many brands within a niche as you want to. And there's no extra or lesser cost for you in doing so. So if you're competing against a supplier, they don't have that superpower. They can only sell their own product, generally. They're only going to be selling their own brand, right? So sometimes in the way around that you can compete with them is by putting products together and making things like bundles or putting additional value into the sale in some other way that they can't do, but that is appealing to your ideal customer, right? So let's say you've got product A and you're competing against the supplier of product A and you feel like they might be winning that because they're the supplier and you're kind of sitting right next to them. Well, say, can I put something else with product A that my ideal customer is going to find appealing that they can't put with it? So can I add another product in there? Change the price. So the price is going to be different, but maybe build a big discount into the other product and use that to sell product A, right? Because the supplier can't do that. It's not going to work for every customer, but it's going to work for a percentage of customers. And so you think a little bit laterally like that, and there can sometimes be an answer there. Once again, that's not going to be the answer in every circumstance, but oftentimes it will be the answer. That's the best I got without looking into the specifics of John's situation. Obviously, if we actually were looking at the niche itself and had a look at the competition and had a look at the pricing and all that sort of stuff, no doubt there might be some other suggestions there. But at a high level, general sense, that's what I got for this one. Hello, Cassie. Thanks for joining. Good to see you, as it were. All right, moving along. Pre-submitted questions still. And don't forget, if you're on live, you can just pop a question in to the live there. So next question is from AFSA. Thank you for your question, buddy. And his question is, my biggest fear... what if all my competitors are niche experts with valid credentials / certifications? I, on the other hand, just know the product, but I don't have any experience in the activity. Have you ever been into such niches? Good question. Imposter syndrome, a very common fear when it comes to business circles. So don't feel bad if you're feeling that. Look, I think to some extent, have I been into such a niche? Every niche I've been into, I've never sold products that I personally have any connection to. Never, not once. And so I've always gone into niches where I have competition, usually who might have been selling those products in some way and or using those products for, you know, years, decades in some cases. It's always worked out for me to one extent or another, right? So it's a fear. It's good to recognize that fear and it's good to be aware of what's happening in your market for sure. But like, is it something you really need to worried about? No, I don't think so. And here's why. In most cases, and for a high percentage of customers, it's just not relevant to the customer. It doesn't matter what you think, right? Or what you're worried about or what you're fearful of. At the end of the day, it matters what your customer's going to think. So bring this back to, what is your customer's interest when they come to your site? It's to find the solution to a problem that they have, and that solution is going to provide them an outcome that they desire. That is why every single person buys products online. That is why every single person buys any product. You have a problem, you need a solution, and you desire the outcome to that solution. That is it. So customers don't really give a shit as long as they're getting the outcome they want, right? So their outcome is not going to be tied up into what you have or haven't done. Does having less experience mean it's going to take you a little bit longer to be familiar with the products and to learn everything, blah, blah, blah? Yeah, sure, probably. But so what? What does that matter? I mean, you're going to have that to one extent or another, regardless of what niche you go into. Because for most people, I think it's unlikely that you're going to go into products that you've already been using for a long time. You know, for some people that happens. For a majority of people, it doesn't. And every day I see people go into these niches where, you know, there's a lot to learn. Maybe there's technical products and they do just fine. So I think it's a fear. It's not an unusual fear. There's nothing wrong with having that fear, but you just need to set it to one side and get on with it. I wouldn't worry about it. So thanks for that question, Afsar. Next question, I'll take a live question from Christopher. Thank you for asking that question. Christopher says, I can't wait to get started with Dropship Breakthrough. I can't wait for you to get started with Dropship Breakthrough either, Christopher. Good idea. And by the way, if anybody would like to also do that, just head to dropshipbreakthrough.com/special or dropshipbreakthrough.com/launch to get our launch program, which is will get you up and running and making your first sales if you'd like to get started. Christopher then asks, is it a decent idea to try to sell things that need installation, like in-ground pools, outside stone fireplaces, new tubs / showers, etc.? Well, at a base level, yes. There's no something requiring installation in and of itself is not a barrier to doing it, to selling it. I've sold many products that need installation. Probably the caveat I would put on it, and once again, like I honestly think you can sell nearly anything. So I'm going to put a little caveat on it for a helpful thing. But once again, this isn't even really like a black or white caveat. Like there's different levels of installation, right? So some installation requires a lot of work to work out what's the right product. So if I take the example of an in-ground pool, now I actually just had one of these put into the property that I live in here in Australia late last year. There's a lot of work goes into, in some cases, working out what is the right in-ground pool and then actually obviously installing it. I mean, it was a lot of work. There are a lot of problems along the way. So, you know, could you drop ship in-ground pool shells? Yes, you could. But there's going to be more work there in terms of the customer journey than, say, a bathtub, which is going to go into somebody's house, right? So there are different levels of complexity, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And I think if I was, you know, if I was thinking about like comparing two niches and they both needed installation, I might think about what is the likely complexity of that installation? Because the more complex it gets, the offset to that needs to be the price of the products, right? So, you know, once again, an in-ground pool shell is significantly more expensive than a new bathtub. So you might say, well, the extra work I'm going to have to do to sell the in-ground pools is worth it because maybe they cost like $20,000 or something. So if I can sell a few of those, it's going to be happy days, even at a, you know, lowish margin. Whereas bathtubs only have to do less work, probably more competitive, you know, so on and such forth. So, I mean, that's a little caveat that I might make, but it's not a barrier. I mean, I've sold $1 million a month in revenue of hardtop metal gazebos, for example, which come flat packed. They all need installation. So it's not a barrier. Some customers will do it themselves. Some customers will hire a contractor to do it for them. That's their problem, essentially. But it does provide opportunities sometimes for you to provide additional value to the customer. So you could help customers in an installation niche, a niche where installation is required. You could help customers to arrange contractors to work with them or to provide some other assistance in there at a cost, you know, that you build some profit into. So there are ways that you can use installation to provide additional value for your customers. So nothing wrong with it. I would definitely go down that path if all of the other boxes in your in your niche idea are checked. All right, back to a pre-submitted question from Kostadin. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, mate. Apologies if I got that wrong. And his question is, how do you determine if a person would be able to do the job you hire them for long term, whether it is content creation or customer service or helping out with the website? Is it as simple as money equals quality? No, it is not as simple as money equals quality. I can say that out of the gate. Definitely not. Oftentimes it's a good indicator, but no, it's not out of the gate. So how do you determine if a person will be able to do the job you hire them for long term? Well, if they can do it in the short term, they can do it in the long term. I mean, there's not really any difference between that. It's your job as somebody's employer. And I encourage people, when you think about hiring for an e-commerce business or a dropshipping business, the tendency people have is to think, oh, I'm hiring virtual assistants. They're not real people, or they're off in the distance. So they're just a widget I'm bringing into my business to help me. Now, hiring somebody here is no different than if you had a business and you were hiring somebody to sit next to you in your office. The minute you start hiring, you're now a leader. You're a business leader. You have to demonstrate leadership qualities, right? Just thinking that you're going to flop somebody in and they're just going to rock and roll forever is ridiculous. And it's way off the mark. And those thought processes, and once again, I'm not saying that the person who's asked the question here has those thought processes. This is just in general something I see from the hundreds of people that we work with, is that people just have this expectation they're going to hire somebody and it's just going to be peachy keens and they're not going to have to do anything forever. Well, that's not the reality. Your job then is to motivate that person. It's to lead that person. It's to make sure and to help them perform at a higher level in the long term. You have to do that proactively as a business owner. But in terms of determining if somebody would be able to do the job you hire them for, look, that'll depend a little bit on the role itself, I think. So for example, if it's content creation, which is one of the examples given, that's a pretty simple one. Check their portfolio. If you're hiring somebody to write content, right? Written content. If they don't have published content already online somewhere else, you shouldn't hire them in the first place. That's an automatic sign that they're probably not going to be able to do it. So they're going to have a portfolio. It's going to be on other websites. Check their references as the next thing, right? So their stuff's on other websites. You can contact that website and say, hey, look, I'm thinking about hiring this person. I understand they've written content for you in the past. I can see it online. What was that experience like? Were they pretty accurate? Did they need a lot of help to get it right, sort of thing? Like, what was the experience like? Check their references. Do that for three references. If that comes back all happy days, then give them a trial. Get them to write something for you on a trial basis. Don't hire them formally until they've passed that trial. If the trial doesn't work out, then they're not going to work out, right? Move on to the next person. Customer service, same thing. Check references. If you're hiring for customer service and you're not checking references, you're doing it wrong, right? You have to do it. If the person won't supply references, you should not hire them. That is an automatic red flag. It's the same. There's just different ways of doing it. You want to look for examples of prior work that's relevant. You want to check references from that prior work, and then you want to trial people. But understand that you also have to have the right processes for developing that person into that position. So once again, I bring it back to, do not hire people with the expectation that they are immediately going to do what you want them to do. You have to get them in there. You have to train them. You have to support them. Getting an understanding about what, you know, motivates people, like what are they looking to achieve with their life? You know, why are they coming to work for your business? I think that can sometimes help. If you're good at reading and understanding people, asking questions of people around that can help you. If you're not really a people person, you're probably not going to get the nuance in asking those questions. And so I wouldn't bother. At the end of the day, every time you hire somebody, there's a level of risk that they're not going to work out long term. And it's just another one of those risks that you take on as a business owner, along with other things. And that's just part of running a business. You have to be okay with taking on risk. And so the best you can do is vet them as much as possible. Put structures into your business to support them and help them in the long term, and also reward them and recognize them for good work and things like that. You know, these are the things that are going to help people to stick with your business. And check in with them regularly along the way. See how they're going. See if they want to do new and different things. See if they want to do things differently, and see if you can support them through that. So once again, there might be more nuance for particular situations there, but at a high level, thanks for your answer there, for sure. All right, let's get back to our live questions now. And thank you. Good to see some live questions coming in, peoples. So live questions. Where are my questions going? There is a question here. Can you clarify more detail about SEO? Absolutely not. That is way too generic, and I do not have 6 hours to talk to you about SEO today. So I would ask you, can you clarify more detail about what you would like to know about SEO? And I'll be happy to answer your question. So I'll move on to another question here. This one is from Cody. It's live. Hi, Cody. Thank you for joining live. Some of my products are in the non-branded space, I think. My question is, how would I set up my Google shopping funnel since I'm not really targeting the name of the brand? Would I use keywords like 25-piece set or set in insert color? The way to think about it, so for anybody who's not familiar with what that question's about, we do first traffic source we use for high ticket dropshipping businesses is Google Shopping. And for high ticket dropshipping products, we do Google Shopping in a very specific way. We call it a shopping funnel, upside down funnel, inverse funnel. We've had a number of different names for it over time. There's no quick way to explain this. You know, three campaigns, each targeting different levels of keyword value. And the answer to your question, Cody, lies in what I just said. So the way we demonstrate the funnel is with the concept of non-branded terms, branded terms, and then product-specific terms like model IDs, model numbers, model names, et cetera, as the type of search terms that we keyword that we target in each campaign. It's not actually about that, though. That's just the most simple way that is relevant to most high-ticket dropshipping businesses that you can demonstrate it in, say, a course or something like that, which is the way that I do it in the Dropship Breakthrough course as a demonstration. But there is a lot more nuance to it than that, even in branded spaces. The key term is what it's about is keyword value, right? And so in a Google Shopping sense, being a primarily bottom of funnel to mid funnel marketing strategy, so Google Shopping is shit at the top of the funnel, generally. There's exceptions, but generally it is. It's not good there. That's better for SEO, organic traffic, that sort of thing. So we're primarily targeting people who already know what they want. They're either solution aware or they're product aware. If we think about the customer awareness pyramid, which is once again another concept I don't have time to go into here. So they roughly know what they want. And so they're more likely to be close to the point of purchase, and they're going to be using more specific search terms. So because they're more specific to individual products and or brands or categories of products, we would say they have more value for our business in a Google Shopping sense. And so oftentimes, if somebody searches, you know, like Apple iPhone 15 Max, blah, 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 you would say they know exactly what product they want to buy. And so if you can put that product in front of them, there's a good chance they might buy it. And so that term has much more value for the business than, say, somebody who's searching for smartphone. What do they want? Well, who knows what they really want, right? And so that's a low value term. Even though the business might sell smartphones, it's a low value term. Whereas somebody who searches for Apple iPhone is closer. They're in the middle somewhere. You know what brand they want. And so if you sell that brand, you can say, yeah, that's valuable. So that's what I mean by keyword value. but you can take out the branding sense of it and still segment the available total bucket of keywords in your market by value, right? And the way you work out value is, how specific can you tie that search term to an individual or small group of products on your site? So I think you're on the right track with your comment. It could be, I would still test the branded element first. Like you can do these two things at the same time. So if you start running your campaigns, I would still, try to push the branded terms and the any model ID, specific product ID type terms into the medium priority and low priority campaigns. If you don't get any traffic, that's a good indication that not many people are searching those terms. So then you could intersperse with that some more specific terms that you see come up in your high priority campaign. So you're on the right track. So like if you sell a 25 piece set of whatever it is you sell, and you've only got one of those, and there's not many of those for sale in your market, then yeah, that would probably be one I might push down. That's a good example. So you're looking for search terms that indicate a very specific product that you sell within your market, or group of products that you sell. That's probably the best way to think about it as to what products you push down. What keywords you push down through the funnel. The other keywords that you would push down through the funnel are going to be terms that convert. So if you see even a generic term, and this is why I say it's not just about branded, non-branded. When we start to see generic terms in the high priority campaign that convert and produce sales, you would also be pushing those down, right? Because you want to get more exposure on those search terms to get more sales out of them. So that's the way that I think about that, Cody. Thank you very much for your question. All right. Jumping back over to pre-submitted questions, Cassie asks a good question. When selling a website, what are the steps needed to do so? What needs to be transferred over? So what business assets, I guess, needs to be transferred over? Well, the start of that question in terms of what steps are needed to do so, the first question is going to be, is it something you're going to do by yourself or something that you're going to do with the help of a broker of some sort? So when I say a broker, I mean somewhere like Quiet Light Brokerage. And that would be, if you're at a higher value, that would be somewhere we would suggest you go and reach out to them. Empire Flippers is another example. And there are other business brokers out there. So if you're at a higher value, like a six-figure business value potentially, or maybe high ticket, high five-figure values, then working with a broker will help you because the sales process is more involved and they will already have, if they're a good broker, a pool of potential buyers that they can put your business in front of straight away who are already vetted as having the sort of money that's required there. You know, you don't want to sell an expensive site by yourself because you're going to have 50,000 tire kickers and it's going to be a nightmare, right? Whereas, a broker is going to also charge you a fee. They're going to charge you a percentage of the sale, right? And that may vary broker to broker. And it may depend on how your business was valued in the first place. But the offset of that is that you know that your business is usually, once again, if they're a good broker, going to be put in front of people who actually have the funding behind them to buy your business rather than just be time wasters. And now if your business is at a lower value, so how do you know if your business has got value? I mean, this is probably another question, right? If your business has at least 6 months of net profit data, then you can apply a valuation to it. If your business hasn't made any sales, you cannot apply a valuation to it. If it's even made only a few sales, I mean, you can't really. I got to be honest. Like to work it out properly at a decent price, you're going to need a monthly valuation. You need at least a monthly or annual net profit figures, and you're going to apply a multiplier to that. What the multiplier is, once again, will depend on different factors. How many traffic sources do you have? How many sales have you been making? What shape is the business in? Like, do you have, you know, employees, like there's a whole range of factors, right, that go in there. So I'm not going to really say what multiplier you're going to get from a high ticket dropshipping business. I've seen anywhere between 18 to 40 times monthly net profit, or, you know, maybe 2 to 4 times annual, something like that, or 2 to 5 times annual, maybe. So it could be, there could be a range. And once again, a broker would help you work that out. So if you're at the stage where you don't have, you know, your business isn't at the point where you can apply a valuation to it, then all you're really doing, the value is going to be completely subjective, because all you're really doing in that circumstance is you are saving somebody else time, and that's what they're paying you for. You're selling them a site that's set up, it's got supplies, it's got products on it. Assuming you've done a decent job of that, then you're saving somebody the time of going through all of that themselves. And what that's worth to somebody, you know, is going to be what it's worth to somebody. You can say what you think it's worth, but ultimately somebody's going to make you an offer, and you'll choose whether you want to accept that or not. So the steps needed to do so, once again, if you're selling with a valuation and you're selling the business based on profits that it's made in the past, you need to make sure you have clean books, right? This is probably the biggest thing. Have straight, clean financial data. Don't try to hide shit. This will be the biggest reason that buyers drop out of your sales process. They're going to do due diligence. People are going to get access to your Shopify account. They're going to get access to your ads account. They're going to get access to your analytics accounts, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to get access to your profit and loss statements, all of that sort of stuff. And so you have to have clean books. If you don't have clean books, you need to get clean books, because you're going to struggle to sell at a decent price without that. And be prepared for a million and one questions about that. Selling a business is at a higher numbers is a very involved process, I would say. Whereas if you're selling a business without sales, I mean, you know, there's not really many steps to do so. Just be clear about what you are including with it. If it's hard to get dropshipping business, it's going to be your Shopify account. It's going to be your domain. It's going to be your ad account. It's going to be your, it's going to be any of those like accounts that you've set up. If you set them up, ads, merchant center, analytics, you're going to need to transfer all of those. So just make a list of what's included. You don't have to transfer, like pass over your business bank accounts or anything. But make a list of what's included. Work out roughly what you should have a starting price that you think, work out what that is, and go and post it in places. Right. I mean, you know, you ask permission, you can post it in our Dropship Breakthrough Facebook groups, see if anybody's interested in buying it there. There are websites out there, like marketplace type websites, where you can list businesses for sale yourself. Shopify used to have one, Shopify Exchange. I think they've shut that down, unfortunately. But there are others out there, Flipper. Can't even remember half of the other ones, but there's ones out there. You can list your business for sale and go through that process yourself. I would be clear that your businesses are not valued on potential. So a mistake that newbies make is saying, well, this business could make $1 million a year in 12 months' time if you put in the work, so therefore you should pay me X amount of money for it. No, businesses never sell on potential. They only sell on results. So nobody cares about the potential, so don't even worry about going there. If somebody is interested and wants to buy from you, I mean, once again, depending on the price, what do you do? Well, you know, if it's a reasonable amount of money, you know, if you're selling via a broker, they're going to manage the whole payment process for you. If you're doing it yourself, you know, let's say you were selling a website for like $10,000. Let's just say, you know, it's going to depend on who's buying it and how comfortable you are with each other. You might choose to use an escrow service for the payment, because obviously you're going to sit there saying, well, I'm not going to transfer anything to you until I know I've got the money. And they're going to say, well, I'm not going to give you the money until you've transferred anything to me. So the middle road is to put it into an escrow service. They pay the money in. The escrow service confirms to you that they've paid it. You transfer the assets over. Once the assets are transferred over, the escrow service, the conditions are met for the sale, the escrow service releases the funds to you. You can draw up a simple little sales agreement before you sell that you can both sign, which just is basically, this is the agreed price. These are the, these are the things that are included. You just put a list, and I would just put a note at the end to say, once payment is made and the assets are transferred, you have no further responsibility regarding the business, et cetera, or any other conditions that you agree with the buyer. You know, what needs to be transferred over? I mean, everything except for your business bank accounts. You don't transfer bank accounts usually. And you may or may not transfer your company. Right? I mean, if your business is set up with a company, you don't have to transfer the company. I mean, you could, but you don't have to. That's probably a question for you more than anything. But everything else goes. Anything else to do with the business, branding, supplier relationships, all of the information that you have regarding your business. You're basically just taking everything you've done and just going plonk. That's it. So hopefully that answers your question, Cassie. Thank you for sending it through. Right. Next question is from Peter. That's an interesting question. Peter, if you have a niche you are in and you are not seeing results, at what point do you call it quits and try again with a new niche? That's a good question, Peter. And the answer to that question is one that a lot of people get wrong. The first thing I would say is that you're unlikely to be able to work that out by yourself. If this is your first foray into high ticket dropshipping, understanding when a niche is a problem because of the niche itself, or when is it a problem because you're not doing it properly? That's the two things. Are you going to understand the difference between those if you try and make that decision yourself? I think probably not. I don't think there are preset criteria. There's probably some indicators that I can say now, but ideally you would find somebody who has experience with high ticket dropshipping, not with other businesses, not with other e-commerce businesses, who can tell you, who can look at it, who can look at what you've done and tell you. Now, if you need to pay for that, then you should pay for that. But that's what you're going to do. But some indicators, or maybe some questions to ask. I don't think there's a set time frame here. That's the first thing I'm going to say. But some questions I would be asking myself, or the things I would look at. If somebody came to me and said, "Hey, John, I've been doing this in this niche for a little while. I'm not quite seeing the results that I think are giving me positive signs, and I'm wondering if the niche itself is a problem or whatever." So things I'm going to look at. I'm going to look at the supplier side of things. So does that person have a good representation of the products within their defined niche that they should have? And not just do they have products in whatever product categories are there, but do they have enough of the different products within each category? So this is probably one of the most common mistakes I see people make when they ask this question, is they've gone out, there's 30 brands in their space, they've gone out and got 3 or 4, launched their business, and then just run ads for a little while and not done anything else, not got many sales, and they're going, "Oh yeah, this niche doesn't work." The reason that almost entirely the reason that is because there's 27 other brands that you didn't get, and you're just not selling the right products in your niche. So you need to go out and blow through that supplier list and really push hard on it. Get some other brands. Like literally every high ticket dropshipping business I've ever seen, sales are dominated by some of the brands and not others. Like everybody has this experience. You will put suppliers on your website that almost never sell, and you'll put some on that sell really well. This is why earlier question I said, one of your priorities needs to be getting more brands. When I consult people on this who are in the early stages of their business, this is something I hammer them on all the time. Did you call more brands in the last month? Right? And if the answer is no, I'm going to say, well, go and do that this month, right? You have to do it. Because you can give yourself a false negative if you just happen to get a small number of brands in the beginning, and they just happen not to be the best ones, or the ones that customers want to buy, or just the ones that sell well online. Some products sell online well better than others. Some products sell better on one site than another, than others. And you see these patterns in every single high-ticket dropshipping business. And before anybody asks, no, there's no way to 100% accurately predict what that's going to be. You just go and do it. And you'll work it out. So, you know, that's something I'm going to look at. I'm going to look at the traffic that's coming into the business and make sure, like, is this business generating the right traffic that's matched to the traffic source that they're getting the traffic from? Because if the answer to that, once again, is no, then like it's not good quality traffic, then it's not a problem with the niche. It's a problem with, you know, the way that the traffic's been generated. I'm going to look at the website and see what work has been done on the website. Like a website has to do certain things in order for it to help in the conversion process. I'm going to look at the website. I'm going to be looking at what's that business's customer service approach, right? So I've had people come to me and like literally and say, oh, I'm not making any sales. I look at their website. They don't have a phone number on their website. And they're trying to sell, you know, $5,000 products. Well, here's a hot tip. You're not going to sell any without a phone number on your website, hardly, right? Just simple fact is, at those sort of price points, a lot of people are going to want to call you before they place an order. A lot of people. Not all of them, but a lot will. So, you know, I'll be looking at those things. Does the business have a clear offer? Is it communicated on the product pages? Has that been researched in relation to the competition in their market? And adjust it accordingly. If the answer to any of those things is no, then once again, it's probably not a problem with the niche. You're not doing a good job of selling your products. So those are probably the three things I would say that I would look at first before making that determination. Now, if I looked at somebody's site and they had were doing all of those things well and it wasn't working out, then maybe I'd be saying, yeah, the niche problem, move on. But if you didn't do any of those things wrong and you go and jump into a new niche, guess what you're going to do? You're going to do the same thing again. You're not going to work out what you did wrong in the last one, and you're just going to repeat your problem again. And this is the problem with trying to determine by yourself when you're brand new to business whether your niche is good or not, is that you're not capable of analyzing your own efforts because you haven't done it yet successfully, so you don't know what that looks like. Right. So if you just stop, and once again, I see people do this often, they'll go through three or four niches and they just keep doing the same thing again and again. And it turns out they're doing the wrong thing. And all they're doing is replicating the wrong thing again and again and again. And that's like, you know, that's bad. And not because they intentionally did that. It's just because they didn't have the experience to look at what they're doing and say, no, I'm actually doing it wrong. If I go and do that again, it's not likely going to work. And I have seen that quite a few times over the years. So thank you for that question, Peter. I hope that enlightens you in some way as you know, if that relates to your own situation. I hope that's helpful in some way. All right, moving along. I'm going to go to the next pre-submitted question, then I'll come back to some a couple of live questions here. This one is from Brian. Brian asks, maybe it's just me, but I feel like folks are very secretive on exactly what their business name / domain name is. I'd love to hear / see what are some of the more successful brands that have been built through this program. And I would assume Brian means the Dropship Breakthrough Program. Not to copy, but to inspire and provide ideas for our businesses. Maybe I'm on an island, but thought I'd throw it out there in the event others feel this way. Thanks, John. Well, Thanks for the question, Brian. No problems. Yeah, look, I mean, I guess, you know, in the dropshipping space, a lot of people don't tend to share, like, I mean, but once again, share their businesses or whatever. I mean, what's the incentive for somebody to share their business? Like, I'm not going to, right? I'm not going to go out and put out a list of what our students' businesses are unless they choose to do that. That's not my place to do that. They're not my businesses. And so if we've got students who don't want to reveal what their business is, I'm not going to go and make them do that. So to answer your question directly for myself, no, I'm not going to do that because they're not my businesses. So, you know, why people do or don't do that? Like, I mean, why would they do that? There's no incentive for our students to go and post publicly, this is my business. If, like, they're not going to get anything out of doing that. I understand you might get something out of doing that. And I can understand where you're coming from with the question 100%. But once again, I mean, I guess people don't do it because there's no reason for them to do it. There's no incentive for them to do it. They're not going to get anything positive out of it, really. And I mean, I got to be honest with you. I can understand, Brian, once again, that you're not coming from a place of wanting to copy people. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there that do that. And it's really fucking annoying. Like literally there are people out there, and we have a business partner, me and Ben, where this happened. Somebody literally copied their entire website, copied their product descriptions, custom product descriptions, everything, and just put up a competitor site and, you know, started running ads in the same space. Unfortunately, that does actually happen. It's happened to me. You know, my first site, which I put out there in a big drop shipping group way back when, I'm talking about seven, eight, 9 years ago, it was copied like 10 times at least in the time that I had it. I sold that site in 2017, but it was copied multiple times by people who saw that I was doing well and were like, oh, well, yeah, easy way into business is just go and copy the same products that John's selling and then get so lazy that we're, you know, going to copy things that he's made up from scratch. And yes, there are ways that you can deal with that, right? Those sites do get taken down. You can do DCMA takedowns, particularly if they use Shopify. Shopify is very supportive in those circumstances, usually. But it does happen. And I guess that's probably, we don't encourage people not to share their businesses or anything like that. But I think there's just a longstanding thing in dropshipping, which is not, once again, not something that we've kind of actively encouraged either, where you don't share your businesses. I would say, however, that a lot of our students do know each other's businesses. So we have a lot of students who are in mastermind groups together, who interact in places like our Slack workspace in our program, who come to our live events, who do know what each other's businesses are and that sort of thing. Because they trust the people that they're talking to, they know from experience that once somebody's up and running with their own business, they're not going to be the sort of person that's going to copy them, or do something like that. And so they'll feel comfortable putting their business out in those sort of ways. So yeah, I think, you know, it is what it is. That's the best I can say. I think it is what it is. If that's a problem that people don't share stuff, then, you know, I'd probably ask why that's a problem, but, you know, it is what it is. Thank you for the question. However, all right. So just coming back to live questions here. I've got a question here and I can't see where the question's coming. Oh, Wayne. Wayne asks, do you recommend a certain number of products to launch? No, I don't recommend a certain number of products to launch. It doesn't really matter. I mean, assuming, once again, you're doing high ticket dropshipping, you can launch with any number of products. You could launch with one supplier, you know, and whatever products they have. If they have 10 products, you could launch with that. Absolutely. Get the ball rolling, you know, get used to running some ads, et cetera, et cetera. For sure, you can do that. You can launch with 2 suppliers, 3 suppliers, 4 suppliers, 10 suppliers, whatever you want. I would go through your first round of supplier contact, you know, see how many you get, get their products online and go with that. The key is, though, as I've said in response to a couple of other questions, I think here is don't stop there. Like the, I think the mistake people fall into is they get, you know, a few brands on board in the beginning. You always get more over time as well. Like you'll get a good number in the beginning usually, but you won't get them all. But then there'll be ones that you'll get later, for any number of reasons. But people get a few on board, they start running ads, they get all tied up in the marketing stuff and whatnot, and they don't keep contacting brands. And I think that can lead you to some false negatives about your business. So whatever you launch with, don't take the foot off the accelerator of getting more brands on your site after you launch. Keep at that. And as I said, that should really be a priority for you for at least your first 12 months in business. And you should keep doing it beyond that as well. Like when, once you're into a niche, you'll keep identifying brands and ways that you can serve your customer for years, right? You just might not do it as frequently as you go, as you get, you know, a business that's a bit older. You might, so I, you know, with an older business, I personally used to just do supplier outreach once or twice a year, get their products online, then focus on selling them. But in the first 12 months, you should literally be doing it every opportunity you have, in my opinion. So thank you for that question, Wayne. All right, going back to here, pre-submitted questions, and I'm moving down to one from Ben. Thank you for your question, Ben. With a funnel type Google Ads campaign, if Google isn't coming close to spending the daily budget, is it a case of just increasing bids? Is this the case for a standard shopping campaign also? Good question, Ben. Thank you for it. The answer is yes. Usually it is. That would be the first thing. So the way that you can tell that, though, and there are some metrics in your Google Ads account that can help you to determine this. The first one I would be looking at is, and you can look at these metrics at a campaign level, at an ad group level, at an individual product level within Google Shopping campaigns. It's going to be the search impression share metric. So search impression share is a measure, it's expressed as a percentage of how many of the available impressions given your targeting settings. Targeting settings means like location, keyword targeting, negative keyword list, etc. What percentage of the available impressions given your targeting settings are you actually receiving? So impressions is the measure, of course, because you need an impression to get a click in the first place. So if your search impression share is low, like if you look at your search impression share for a given time frame, and I would look at a bit of a longer time frame, ideally if you can do a month at least, that's a good measure. If you can't, at least make it a couple of weeks. And let's say your search impression share on a campaign is less than 10%. It'll show the little less than arrow and then 10. That means that you're not getting anywhere near in front of all the impressions. And yes, you should increase your bids, right? If your impression share is 100% on the flip side, that means you're already getting in front of all of the impressions given your keyword targeting, like whatever keywords you're targeting in that particular campaign, right? So increasing your bids is not going to get you more impressions in that example. What I would look at as a secondary metric there from there to work out how you could spend more is your click-through rate. So if you've got high impression share and a low click-through rate, then that means that you're getting impressions on the page, but people aren't clicking your ads. And so they're not spending anything. So a low click-through rate, once again, will vary. Your question is a two-part question about standard shopping campaigns or also the sort of funnel that we use. A good click-through rate is going to be anywhere between anything probably over 0.8%, ideally over 1%. Right. If it's like, if your click-through rate's like 0.1 or 0.2 or 0.3 or 0.4, unless it's a very broad campaign, and I struggle to see why you would want that, but you know, let's just say maybe if it's a broad campaign, that would be okay. Your click-through rate's going to be too low. So if your click-through rate's too low, then there's two things you want to look at there. First is going to be is your keyword targeting. Are you just getting a bunch of really irrelevant traffic? And you're just getting impressions. but it's for trash, shitty traffic. And so you're not getting any clicks. But then I would look at a secondary search impression share metric, which would be search absolute top impression share, which is going to tell you of the times that you get an impression, how often are you at the top or to the leftmost if it's in the horizontal ad listings, right? So if you've got a high search impression share but a low top impression share, then that probably indicates that people are clicking on other ads before yours just because you're not showing at the top. People tend to click at the first things they see, honestly, in most cases. And so in that circumstance, I would also be increasing my bids to see if I can increase my top impression share. Almost always, assuming all of your products are live and all of that sort of thing, if you're not spending your budget, it's because your bids aren't competitive enough. If you're using the funnel type Google Ads campaign that we use, and we're talking about, say, your low priority campaign, I guess the other way to look at that could be that if you're targeting very specific search terms in that campaign, there's just not enough of those searches happening. So this is sometimes where people find out that individual brands that they sell don't get much branded search, is because they try and target the brand's brand name or the model IDs or something, and they get no traffic. But their search impression share is really high. The reason is because almost nobody's searching those search terms. So you need to change your keyword targeting. That can sometimes be the case if you're talking about the funnel-based system that we use. So I hope that helps, Ben. Thank you for the question. All right. Moving back to live questions. Wayne asked a follow-up question. Thank you, Wayne. I have suppliers giving 30% margins. Do you think that is enough to be profitable, or should I skip those and find ones with better margins? Looking at price points around $1,500. Yes, Wayne, that will be fine. Depends on the product, maybe. I mean, if those are really big and heavy products, then, 1,500 isn't a particularly appealing price point. But, 30% on 1,500 is $450. You have to take into account, the main thing you have to take into account there is what's the arrangement for shipping the products and how much is that likely to cost, right? If it's an average size product, that's going to be fine. Like I say, if it's a really big and heavy product, then the rule for really big and heavy products is they need to be expensive. $1,500 isn't expensive when it comes to high ticket, right? Out of all products it is. But 30% is usually a fine starting point, yeah. If I just talked about on average. But there could be some circumstances where it might not be quite ideal. But yeah, I would definitely be using those products. 100%. All right, back to pre-submitted questions. Oh, this is coming to the last pre-submitted question, I think. This is from Olaf. Thank you for your question, Olaf. I feel like the biggest problem that my head cannot get around is finding my niche. I'm mostly into sports, active lifestyle, longboards and skateboarding, and tech. And it feels like everything I think of has already been done. All right, he has a second question. So I'm just going to go with that one first. So what is my answer? I mentioned this earlier. Look, it's nice if you can sell product, like build a business that's in a niche that you're passionate about yourself. That's cool, right? But it's not always going to be the case, right? I've never done that. Like quite literally. I can't think of a single product I've ever sold where I'm like, if this product didn't exist in this world, I wouldn't care. Like, I really wouldn't. I love the business. I'm passionate about building and running my businesses. That's my passion. I'm passionate about the lifestyle it creates for me. I'm passionate about the options it gives my children because I'm successful at it, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I care about. The products are just a vehicle to me. And I can tell you I've been doing that for 10 years and it's not a problem. So, I think honestly, my answer is if you really want to do this because you want the results of what doing business can provide, like who cares about the product? Right? Don't hold yourself. You could go around on that for like a decade, just like, oh, I can't find the right product. And you wake up 10 years later and you've done nothing. And that's a massive wasted opportunity, because that whole time you could have been doing things that, yeah, you don't love the product, but you're making money. You're building a lifestyle. You're building a business. You're building multiple businesses. You're selling businesses. Like, you could have done all of that in the time that you're like going around about, oh, I'm waiting for the perfect business idea, or I'm waiting for conditions to be perfect. This is almost the number one reason why most people don't achieve some of the things that they think they want to achieve, is because they wait for all the conditions to be lined up. They wait for the perfect time to do things. And this is not just with business. You know, it can be with other things. Starting a family, for example. Oh, I have buying a house. Like, I have to wait for conditions to be perfect before I can take that action. Well, conditions are never perfect. And if you wait for things to be perfect, if you wait for the right business idea to come along, if you wait for the right product to pop into your head, chances are that you're just never going to do anything. And that is like, that is the worst thing. That is the worst thing. You might say, well, I'll still be there in my safe little bubble that I'm currently in or whatever. But no, like, that's a, to me, that's a wasted life personally. So like, I don't really care about that. Find a product that ticks the boxes and start selling it. Like, learn how to do the business anyway. And if that perfect thing for you comes across your desk at some point, jump on it for sure. If a better product comes along, you can do that. Like, you're not locked into the thing you're going to start with forever. I started selling chandeliers, ceiling lights, pendants, outdoor lights, wall lights, things like this. What a shit niche. I don't care about those products at all. I've never owned a chandelier, and I kind of hope I never do, to be honest. So what? Like, if I hadn't gone and done that, I wouldn't be sitting here doing what I'm doing now. Like, 10 years later, I haven't worked a day job in that time, you know, like, blah, 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 all the stuff that I wanted to achieve when I start opening that chandelier business, I've pretty much achieved. Now I have a new set of goals and so on. But like, if I had have sat there and gone, oh, I don't like chandeliers, I can't do that, and wrung my hands about it for ages, I would have done nothing. I'd still be working a day job that I don't like, commuting 3 hours a day and so on and such forth. So I think, honestly, get your head around it. Like, just make the choice and realize that what you're really doing here is you're like, see if you can get passionate about what the business can provide you, regardless of what you sell. And I think that's the way my mind works around that sort of thing. The second part of Olaf's question is, second one is about digital drop shipping. Oh, great. Oh, yeah. I've seen the ads for this stuff, the TikTok boys and the pimply-faced teenagers talking about digital drop shipping. What do you think about it? I don't mean in the sense that I would be doing my own courses, but rather buying out licenses and selling them in bundles. Cheers from Poland. So digital drop shipping, if for somebody who hasn't heard that term yet, it's a new thing. I guess you're probably going to see 50,000 Facebook ads or TikTok ads or wherever you hang out online about this stuff. I've already been seeing them. They're moderately amusing. The idea is that you're getting digital products and you're selling them on a website. They're not necessarily products that you created. And look, I'm not going to pretend like I'm an expert on exactly how this is being done today, because quite frankly, I don't really care, but also because this is not new. This is just licensing digital products and selling them online. This is a business practice that has been happening for a long time. Somebody's just joined the dots and they've put digital info products together with drop shipping, because drop shipping is something that people talk a lot about online, right? But this business practice, taking information products, getting a license to use them, whether it's a course, books, you know, all sorts of things, and selling it, I mean, that's not new. This has been happening for ages. What do I think about it? It can work. I mean, like, literally almost any business idea you can think of can work, right? If you really want it to, and in with the right conditions. Here's like, and so I'm sure there is some model out there that somebody's got, or some method of determining whether a digital product would be good to sell as a third party, right? As the person who didn't create it, you know, in a licensed sense. I'm sure there is some model to determine that. I can certainly think that there would be a lot out there that it wouldn't work. And it would depend on the price point, I would think, as well. So I'll give you an example, right? I mean, if you were to, and I can tell you this as somebody who sells Dropship Breakthrough, is a digital product, is an information product, right? It ain't easy to sell. It's much easier selling physical products. I can tell you that right now. If you were to try and sell like a course the same as Dropship Breakthrough, let's say, you wouldn't have any luck, right? You would rarely sell it unless you sold it dirt cheap, like, and I mean like $20 or $30 or something like that, which might be the business model. Like I say, I don't know, but you're not going to sell it. And the reason is because like people buy like our program, generally speaking, because of our reputation, right? Because me and Ben have been doing what we preach for a decade each. So combined 20 years of experience. And because we've got, you know, student results and blah, 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 and all of that sort of stuff. Because people listen to our podcast, listen to 50 episodes of our podcast, and they know that we're the real deal, right? This is why people join what we do. Now, if you take me and Ben out of it, this business has little to no value. Like if you're just some third party and you're like, oh, yeah, I'm not actually a dropshipper, but here, buy my course about dropshipping. I just don't see that working. But that's quite a complex business, like quite a complex topic for a course. So like I say, I could imagine it working if you had a little course that answered a simple question about something that people didn't need to be satisfied that you like had much expertise in, right? I could see that happening and potentially working. So once again, like if I'm in a decision between would I do high ticket drop shipping or digital drop shipping, and without having a massively, I mean, I know the historical sense of selling information products online, like I get that, and I don't think it's any different, but like I take physical products every day of the week. Personally, I don't really see, if I was going to do digital drop shipping, I would probably just do affiliate marketing, right? Because once again, the people with the best courses are not licensing them out, right? Like we're never going to license out like the rights to Dropship Breakthrough unless we want to stop doing it altogether, right? Never going to do that because why would I? Like it produces money for me. Why would I give the rights to sell that to somebody else when I can just get all of the customers for that? But however, we do have affiliates who are people who go out and do stuff and promote our course and in return get paid for doing that, right? So I think if I was going to be like, if I would prefer probably to do affiliate marketing and get access to the best courses, because all the best courses pretty much have affiliate network products that you can promote for them and all of that sort of thing. I'd probably just do that, to be honest, if it were me. But, you know, maybe on that, I'm speaking out my ass. Maybe the pimply-faced teenagers have a great model for doing this that I'm just not aware of yet. And I'd love to be proven wrong on that for sure. All right. Okay, so that is the end of the pre-submitted questions. Thank you for those. There's a couple of live ones left. Wayne asks, Klaviyo or just use Shopify email? Use Klaviyo. Well, yeah, personally, I don't like Klaviyo for reasons. However, Shopify email is way too basic in the long term. Like you need a proper email autoresponder. Klaviyo Drip is another good example. There are others out there as well. Shopify email is way too basic. It doesn't do the things you need it to do when you actually get into email marketing solidly. So you're better off setting up and populating a good email tool earlier on. Even if you don't do a lot of email marketing, I would still get it hooked up and get things like your abandoned, you know, cart emails into it and all that sort of thing. And then when you get into more advanced email marketing, which for a high ticket dropshipping business, to be honest, you shouldn't even be paying attention to that. for 6 to 12 months into your business, right? Like email marketing is not going to be the thing that grows your business early on. There are other things that are going to get you to the revenue levels where it makes sense to start leveraging email. But in the beginning, I mean, unless you're at least 50,000 a month in sales, I really wouldn't be worrying about email marketing. Other than having like just the basics in place, like you need an abandoned checkout email flow, like, you know, 5 to 7 emails. You need like a little welcome series for new customers. So you need the basics, but that's really like the basics of email marketing. Email marketing is a strategy way bigger than that. And the way bigger than that part, you don't need to worry about.
Thanks for listening to the Dropship Podcast. You can find all the show notes for this episode at dropshippodcast.com. And if you're ready to take the next step in your dropshipping journey, we invite you to join us inside Dropship Breakthrough, where John and I will walk you through step-by-step in starting your own high-ticket dropshipping e-commerce business. But that's not all. Dropship Breakthrough will also teach you everything you'll need to know to grow your business and take it to the next level. So head over to dropshipbreakthrough.com and sign up for our free training that will help you take the first steps towards building and growing your own profitable high-ticket dropshipping business. John and I both love business, think about it all the time, can't turn it off, and don't know why anyone would want to. And because of that, we started a second podcast where we can talk about everything we've ever wanted to talk about in business. Not just dropshipping. We like talking about all things business. So if you want to hear John and I talk about all sorts of stuff, from camel meat dropshipping businesses to PDF dropshipping to a guy gambling $100 every single day on YouTube Shorts to how OnlyFans taught us lessons in business, we're all over the place over there, but it's a really fun podcast. So if you're a podcast listener, you love John and I, head over to your podcast player of choice and look for the Low Bar Podcast. You'll see a blue image and you'll see a cartoon version of John and myself. And go back and start at episode 1. I promise you will not regret this. This is one of the more fun projects that I have done recently. I know John's having fun too, so we'd love it if you joined us. Check out the Low Bar Podcast on YouTube or wherever you prefer to listen to podcasts.